You are listening to Aloud, a program of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit us at lfla.org.
Back there, very unprofessionally. I love the show, but it's fantastic. One of the most amazing things about the show is that it has always seemed to be one step ahead of the headlines. And I'm sure you hear this all the time. But, you know, Margaret Atwood had said of the book, she called it speculative fiction. So how do you see the series in that sense? Because people seem to say you can't like see around these corners.
Well, I think that we really take our cue in everything from Margaret Atwood. You know, in the prescience of the series, is the book was just as prescient, you know, all the way from the time it was written. You know, it seemed like it was always this incredible time to read The Handmaid's Tale. And so, you know, the show, we're playing in a world that she populated with the issues that we're going to be dealing with forever. And she's a very smart woman, so I follow directions well.
So initially, when you're looking at turning this into a television series, was it terrifying, the thought of even tackling this book? B, you know, we talk about her involvement, just the whole thing, how this kind of started up and what a mountain that is to climb.
There's an idea that you're kind of waiting for these projects to come along, but it doesn't happen that way. I had read this book in college. I had always been interested in it, and it had been in development to be a show for a very long time, other places. And I just checked in every year when I wasn't working. And so there happened to be, they were looking for a showrunner when I wasn't working. But if that hadn't happened, I mean, I have a mortgage. You know, I would have gotten another job and done something else. And so it was a lovely opportunity. But if the timing had been wrong, I would have gone off and done something else because it wouldn't have worked out. And they also were only looking at women for the showrunning job, which I was on their side, except I wanted the job. So
that's amazing. Was there, number one, was there any kind of pushback initially, like, wait a minute, this has got to be a woman that does this?
Oh, yeah. And I was terrified. But when I went in and pitched, it was very strange. They met with all these women before they met with me. They, you know, they didn't even want to meet with me, and then they did, and I went in and pitched. And really, I had been a big fan of the book. Mm. So my pitch was really, I like this book. Let's make it into a TV show, you know, like this book. And when I basically pitched what Margaret wrote, and they were like, that's amazing. No one else pitched anything like that. I have no idea. What do you pitch? I was incredibly, you know, boring. I'm just going to put this in final draft and give it back to you. And that's kind of what I did. And I think every time I made the decision to follow the book, even when I didn't understand what Margaret meant, those have been some of the best moments.
Wow.
Those moments of, like, faith where you just go, well, she is much smarter than me. So. But it is terrifying because she's alive.
Well,
yeah.
I was going to say, because you, when we had talked earlier, you'd also said that was the first book that really kind of either taught you how to be a writer.
Yeah.
And so you're looking at it from that aspect, too. It's not just that story. It's like you are a writer, and this is something that...
When you go onto a project like this, you know, and I really saw it as something that I really thought could be good. I had read it in college, and since then, I had thought about it as a story, a visual story, and that was the thing about the writing that really taught me what to do, how to do what I do, because Margaret really writes it's very simple visual stuff. And so I had a lot of chance to, as I was learning how to write TV series, to do that. And but when you get it, you know, there's a big Emmy on your keyboard, and you can either win it or not. And it's sitting there, and it's really hard to type around it. So what you have to do is throw it away, and because it's, you know, it's The Handmaid's Tale. It's, you know, it should be great if I don't mess it up. Yeah.
Right. And so her involvement in it, can you talk about like working with her on that first season and what it's been since we're now heading into season 5, which is incredible also. Congratulations.
Thank you. It's remarkable. Working with Margaret has been exactly what you all think it would be. It's an absolute pleasure. She is so smart and so, you know, fertile. All this stuff is, you know, she keeps putting out books in the middle of all of this stuff. She, books of poems and all this. Anyway, when it was lucky because she really had a history of having this book adapted. So it had been a play, a couple of plays, I think. It had been a movie. It had been an opera. Still is all of those things. And it, so she was kind of more used to it being changed than I was willing to change it.
Wow.
She was much more, why don't you do this? And I was like, no, we can't. That's not in the book. I can't do that. And so she was very encouraging. But when I wrote my first draft and sent it to her, it was the first 2 episodes I sent to her. I didn't go to the bathroom that weekend. I mean, it was horrifying. You know, it's like impossible. There's no way you cannot mess up. But luckily, she hadn't liked the script before that she had read. So luckily, she was expecting something that was going to disappoint her. So I snuck by. But since then, I'm very happy to say I count her as my friend. We are, you know, we've been through a lot. COVID. She lost her partner last year, of many, many years. And I would talk to her every week if she had any time for me. She's so much busier than I am, and I'm busy. But she's like doing a zillion things all over the world. She always has been. And so I generally, we kind of meet about 3 times a year, you know, in general. So sometime at the beginning of the season, we start talking, and I start talking to her about what I'm doing that season. And then about halfway through the season, that's when we really start. I talk to her about what I think I'm going to do the next season, because it's about halfway through the season I have to start thinking about where it's going to end. And since, unfortunately, it isn't another group of writers, it's us, we can't hang ourselves on a terrible cliffhanger at the end, because it's us that has to solve that problem. So, you know, in the old days on network shows, oftentimes they would clean house at the end of a season. So you could literally have the bomb counting down to 0, and it's like, I don't care.
I'm, you know, handing it
what
off.
What do I care? They'll hire some smart writers, it'll be great. So Margaret and I, we talk about the season to come, and mostly what it is at the very beginning, there were a few things where I was like, maybe this direction, maybe that direction, and she said this direction. Now it's, I'm just kind of running things past her as a writer, and she's talking back to me as a fan of the show, and that's about it. And she knows all of the actors. She's, you know, they're in Toronto. They have own personal relationships with her. She certainly fell in love with Ann Dowd, who plays Aunt Lydia, enough to write another book about her.
Wow.
So if it isn't hard enough following Margaret Atwood, now I also have to, like, introduce, she's on both sides now. She's telling me where my story starts, and she tells me where it ends. So probably best that way.
So when you were going into season 2, right, because you're going off the book when you're going into season 2, and I guess this goes for when you're moving into all the seasons now, but, like, how are you looking at how does it work when you're looking at what you're going to face? Because when you're talking about women and a patriarchy and all this abusiveness, I mean, there is just a ton you can pick from, correct? So,
yes.
You know, how do you form the stories? How do you figure out where you're going?
Well, the first thing we do is definitely you go back to what Margaret Atwood said, which is nothing happened in the book that isn't happening to women or hasn't happened in the past to women. And we adopted that for the show. Unfortunately, it's very easy to, I mean, you can find any kind of terrible thing. But the idea of sitting and making up kind of cruelties to visit on your characters just seems like it's pornography, not.
Yeah.
So I have to say, I've been doing this a long time, and partially, I have a very good relationship, a very good partnership with Lizzie Moss. She's an executive producer, she's an actor, and also a director now of a few episodes. And so we always follow June. 100% of the time. And most of the time, the structure is what would really happen. So if June's trying to escape and they capture her, she's trying to escape again. She didn't succeed. She's trying to escape. Mm. So we try to keep it very basic. What we do is dig around in those stories. Like, how is she going to escape? What happens to her along the way when she's... But really, one of the reasons the show is kind of unexpected is because we often do exactly what would happen. Not what would happen on TV, but what would normally happen. Like, June runs and she gets caught. Because you run and you get caught because they're a totalitarian state and she's a one woman and of course they'd catch her.
Right, yeah. Right.
And so we try to really keep it, but it's unexpected. For example, there was an episode last year where June was tortured to kind of give away her partners, to give away where all the other handmaids were. And the whole discussion in the writer's room was, well, how's she not going to? I'm like, no, she's going to talk. Everybody talks.
Right.
Of course she's going to. It's just a question of how we do it. But that is, you kind of put your head in the other. It's like on most TV shows, it's how's that person going to stand up? No, it's how's she going to fold? What does it take to make her fold?
Yeah. But in that, like, she has become this kind of superhero in a way with that kind of vulnerability, with that kind of humanness. I mean, I think it's the idea of looking at that, and it is realistic. It is realistic that she is going to go back in and make that choice. I'm going back in for my kid. And it's, you know, otherwise it's like, why are you going back in? But it's like, of course she would, right? And so, I don't know, I think that red cape that had been this thing she was forced to wear all of a sudden is like become this symbol of her resistance and her strength in a way. And I think that's amazing.
I agree. And it is amazing. And the iconography, a lot of that iconography was Anne Crabtree designed those costumes at the very beginning. You know, we tried many different milliners to get the correct. Went through 5 or 6 milliners to get the hat right. And we, you know, it was tough to figure out because you don't want the kid, you don't want them to look like Holly Hobby. Because it'll stick out too much. And you don't want them to look like a horse, you know, if it's... I actually thought it was going to be ridiculous, the hood, the things. And so, I also thought, we're never going to be able to use them because you can't shoot in something that would be dark in there. You know, you can't shoot. So we made it out of, like, rice paper. So actually, they're so thin that they let the light in, and we shoot, it, especially in the first few seasons, we're way up in her grill.
Yeah.
You know, we're way up in Lizzie's face, and it's an 18-millimeter lens, which means we're closer than it seems like we are. We're a little closer than it seems like we are. So the camera's right here to the point where she turns her head, and it clocks on the camera. But we make it out of rice paper, and then you throw them away. They don't last. If they get wet, they fall apart. They're terrible. I mean, it's terrible. They're, you know.
Wow.
But that lets the light in so that you get that kind of cool glow around their face, and that was a big deal because I didn't know how we were going to do all those little things that you don't know how you're going to do, we had to figure out at the beginning.
Well, also you have to create Gilead, right? So you've got to have the weird double birthing chair. You have to have...
That was pretty cool, though, wasn't it?
Well, cool wasn't the word I'd use, but yeah.
They asked me if I wanted it, and I said no. Thank you.
I mean, if you could just talk about some of that logistical stuff. I mean, we had talked about... It's horrifying in one way, but like the whole idea of the bed... Of getting the height of the bed right for those horrible scenes with June and the commander and Serena.
There's a ton of logistics that go into it. So that was when we first filmed the ceremony scene. Mm. Just having the first day that Elizabeth Moss and Alexis Bledel were playing, they're supposed to be walking partners. Well, they spent an hour in the morning figuring out how the other one walked. So that they would walk together like this. And so they worked all that out together, those two actors, on their own, because they had so many details, like you said, that are so hard. So when we did the first ceremony scene, which is the where they try to impregnate the handmaids, and it's supposed to mimic this Bible verse. So it's you know, it's a menage a trois. So you've got poor June, the handmaid, is laying on the bed with her legs open. The commander is having sex with her from the front, but he's looking at his wife, who's kind of sitting on her head, not in a comfortable way. And it's all very scary and morose and all that kind of stuff. Well, we had to figure out how to do it, and our director of that first was our first, those first episodes were Reed Morano, who is just like the, such a tough, like badass, like nothing shakes her. She's, you know, she was a director of photography, covered in tattoos. She's fabulous. Joe Fiennes is the most wonderful gentleman in the world. He can't even watch the show. He hates Fred so much. He's just a delight. Lizzie is, as it's so funny because you sit and watch. I was doing editing all day long, and she's so upset all the time. And she's so good that you believe she's upset. She's not upset. And she always says to you, you know, I'm not really sad. I'm pretending to be sad because that's my job, because I'm trying to pretend to be sad. And so she, so as soon as it's over, she's like, ah, laughing and stuff. Now, Yvonne, who looks just, I mean, she's stunningly beautiful. She's also like an Australian. A big, gangly, 14-year-old Australian, you know, kind of fart jokes and kind of this and that.
Mrs.
And
so, Waterford tells fart jokes.
Yes, absolutely. So those three are together trying to figure this out, and it was hilarious. And what, because they couldn't, for 1 minute, you know, keep their faces straight. So, but what we needed to do was figure out how it worked, and part of it was the bed had to be at the right height. For Fred, it, you know, because he couldn't really bend down or stand on a box or something. So we were having this discussion, and it starts with the discussion of, does every commander have to do this? Figure, does every commander have his wife bed adjustable so that he can stand and do this? But it was such a weird detail, and it was so hard for us to figure out. And there's poor Joe, who's the nicest man. You're going, if I do this, would it be easier? You know, he's just the most lovely gentleman. But it set up a system or set up an environment that's very healthy. We have, I think because it seems so hard, the stories are so difficult and stuff, it is on the other side of casual, amongst casual and respectful. Lizzie says that our set has, it's like the manners of when you go to visit your grandmother, but there's a lot of swearing. There's a lot more swearing than when you go to visit your grandmother.
Well, all of, you know, what you're tackling in every episode all the time is all these taboos, and that, you know, that's like one example of it. When you're in the writer's room, can you just talk about who's in the writer's room? When you're looking at this, is it predominantly women? Can you just talk about that?
Well, yes, it's predominantly women. There's not just in that. We tried to, you know, kind of, when the show started out, there wasn't quite as much of a push for women as producers and especially as department heads. So we tried to, that's where we tried to start, is both hiring a line producer who was a woman, but also the heads of the departments, so that the departments were run by those people. So, which wasn't hard, and they were all spectacular. But the writer's room is here in Los Angeles. I don't, you know, I just, we assume everybody knows how these things work because I live in Los Angeles, but a TV show, we have a bunch of writers, we sit together and talk about the show and actually put up on a board like this just what we think is going to happen. And it's just like when you and your friends sit and go, you know what I would like to happen on Handmaids? Except we're so much better at it than you are. And also that when we do it, it actually happens. So, it's actually, we have a fairly big room. We have 10 or 11 people. And the first season, it was me and Eric Tuckman and all women. I think we have one more man now. So we tried to have as many women in the room as we possibly can at every level. But you're also trying to have, we have, you know, lesbians on the show and tons of women of color and all these different interactions. And so you have to try to be as diverse as you can be with everything in your room. But most importantly, it's, you can imagine the things you have to talk about are a little dicey. People tell stories, and you have to not just be comfortable telling a story about something that happened to you, but you have to be comfortable with everybody else, not out of purient interest, but out of needing to know for the show, asking you really intimate questions, especially me, who doesn't understand. There's parts of being a woman and walking through a world as a woman that I cannot understand. You have to explain to me in tiny little detail. There's a scene in that you can't talk about, but there's a scene in the episode I was editing today, which is episode 501, so the first episode of the new season, and there's a scene where a bunch of female characters eat a lot. And all the female writers on the show had pitched that idea about they're in a diner and they're just shoving food in their mouth, and how difficult or fraught that was for some women to eat in public, like shoving food in your mouth. And I'm a boy, and it never occurred to me. So they had to talk me through it like I was an idiot so that I could write it so that it actually felt real. So that's a lot of it. It's not just having women in the room, but women in the room who are patient explaining and don't roll their eyes because you don't understand something. They are very happy to explain anything. And I know I've known them all for a long time. And you also have to be willing to use their judgment over your own. So if you say, this is the way this would go, and they say, no, I think it would go this way, you have to be willing, even if you disagree, to defer to someone who knows better than you.
Right.
Yeah. It doesn't happen that often. I mean, there's not that many things that are mysteries.
But I mean, I think that also marks a real change in like what we're seeing in television. I mean, not so much film, I don't think, but I think television has gotten to some really interesting places. A, because a ton of space opened up.
Yeah.
But B, because I think this is happening more often. And
I never thought they'd let me put on the stuff that I put on. Every episode, I think they're going to say, are you kidding? I mean,
I was going to ask you that. Has there been things like, are you kidding? Like, this is not going to happen.
Well, I mean, now my company has, Hulu's been bought by Disney. So now I work for Disney. I mean, I started making an MGM show for Hulu, and now I make an Amazon show for Disney. But Disney is different. It feels different. We cut off Rory Gilmore's clitoris the first season. Not on camera, but we did.
Not and very Disney.
I thought they were just going to absolutely balk, but they didn't. They've been wonderful and brave all the way through, and I think that as long as they think it's well done and not, we're not doing it in a way that's more gross or more graphic than it has to be to tell the story. That's where we're always trying, because there are lots of things in this show that are very graphic, but you have to feel them with June, or you can't understand why when she finally gets to Toronto, she can't just go, oh, that was awesome, that was awful, put that behind me, because you have gone through it with her, not just heard about it. So that's, I mean, she's a trauma survivor, and so are we with her.
And I think also, you know, you had said this earlier, there's a difference between like misery porn or whatever you want to call it, because there's several things with this show. I mean, number one, you know, you're taking situations that are happening somewhere in the world. I mean, you have talked about, you often are in contact with the UN. And can you talk a little bit about that? Because I just want to say, some of the earlier episodes and even now, my family's Iraqi, and one of the things that I see when I see coverage of whatever happened in the war there, you don't see the women. You don't see what happens with the women. You see what happens with the women and him. And to me, that just hit at the core of like what happens with war. Men start out the shit, and then the women, what happens? Here you see it. So, yeah.
No, you asked the question again. I got caught.
I'm sorry. So I went off on a little tangent there. But so if you can just talk about the UN, contact with the UN, and what that informs on the show.
At a certain point very early on, I kind of realized the show's about a refugee. I mean, she's a pre-refugee before, and then she's a refugee. And there's so much of that out in the world now that it's really easy to find stories that are parallels and how difficult it is to be a refugee, and especially how difficult it is when you're not really suited for it. Like you're an American woman from Boston who was living in her apartment, or you're from the Ukraine and you were, you know, working at a, you know, Starbucks. You know, mm-hmm. But you know, so I think that it makes it easier for me to relate to her. But the UN has been wonderfully helpful. I definitely feel like they've brought a ton of resources to help us. There's always people to talk to who have done these things. What's it like in a refugee camp? But also refugees have come in and talked to us, and what's it like? And some of the things are so fascinating. One of the people talk on the show about why June hasn't been to therapy when she got to Toronto, and that was from this woman we met. She goes, why would I want to go there and fucking say it over and over again? I don't want to say it again. So there's a whole patch of these people who it's like, I don't not remember it. I don't need to process anything. Thank you very much. I went through it. I'm not going to sit down and brief you on it. And so a lot of those things that are so counterintuitive to me, they are, so we had to really do our research so that stuff rings true, and even more so as she's out of Gilead. But Luke is a refugee and traumatized. He was shot. He, crawled across the border. People were killed at the end. So if, for example, if Luke was one of your friends, he'd probably be the most traumatized person you know. But we just know June, too, and Moira. And, I mean, his trauma seems minor compared to the trauma of so many other people. But it's amazing how so many people are traumatized in this story. But the UN, there's the how nations talk to each other and how nations kind of work out their problems. There's a lot of that in the show. It all has to be done through June. You know, as you were saying, when we hear about wars, we always see it, or often we see it through the men's point of view. Also, when we see it from a woman's point of view, there's a limited nature to that in this story, because June at the beginning doesn't know anything. And part of the thing that makes the show work for me is the fact that she knows less, because it makes it more scary, it makes it more, but it also is kind of relatable. She doesn't have too many facts about Gilead, neither do we. So every time I've thought, oh, now's the time I should really show the bigger world, or I should, it always is better to stay with Lizzie.
Right.
And then feel what she's feeling. So sometimes you don't see these huge things that you'd see on another show, and we don't do them because, Lizzie's looking out her window in the Waterford house, and she wouldn't ever know that that happened.
But you still get at it in those little moments. It still gets to, and I think there was something in season four where they are in that therapy circle for a minute, right? And the idea of, we have to heal, and she's like, why?
Yeah.
Why don't we fight? It's like rage versus
why can't I be as angry as I am?
Exactly. And I thought that was an excellent point. How often do you get to see that?
Well, there's a lot in the show, this season especially. Season five is really about what do women do with their rage in general? We've had lots of conversations like that. And is there room, is it okay with June with this huge trauma are you allowed to ever have fun? Or do you have to be traumatized all the time? When do you get to, have some other little corners that you can live in?
Right.
And so that, it's very interesting. Is her whole personality defined by trauma? Then they define her. But it feels weird to move on from all those deaths and all those losses and everything. You just feel like there's no way to put it behind you.
So. Right. Yeah, but also having a sense of humor. I cannot look at a box of Fruit Loops without... I don't know if you guys remember the line, but wasn't it like...
Blessed be the Fruit Loops.
Blessed be the Fruit Loops. That was one of my favorites.
Well, humor is definitely... we talked about the things... What's left when people are in, kind of totalitarian states? And one of the things that's left is people don't lose their sense of individual style. No matter what. No matter what they make people wear, they jazz it up their own way. So all the handmaid's outfits are different. A little bit. They have different belts, OBs, those belts. They're slightly different colors because it's all supposed to be natural dyes. So the more they're washed, they get dirtier, and they're all dirty around the bottom. But they some of them tuck their bag in their belt. Some of them wear, their hood on the inside, some on the outside. Some wear their fingerless gloves. It's really interesting. One of the other things is gossip never goes away. So, that's what the handmaids live on at the beginning is gossip. They just, all they want to talk about. And the other thing that really does not go away is sense of humor, especially when June is like, honestly, this is so, she's constantly looking around for the camera to go, gee, really? This, especially right. with Serena, you cannot believe that this intelligent woman is treating you like this. And finally you say to her, how can you do this? And she's like, shut up. You're like, oh my God, I finally say, you feel like if you could just talk to someone face to face, you would be able to convince them, but no.
Right.
Yeah. Oof.
Okay, I have a question that somebody had given us beforehand. Has the political climate changed the way the show is written?
No, not at all. I think that the people who write the show are generally kind of news junkies, political people, not by any choice, just the happen to be the people that you know, I tend to hire writers who I've worked with before. I'm allergic to change. So, and so they just happen to be a very kind of political, very much in the cutting edge of what issues are in the paper and stuff. So we don't do much more than that. I mean, I think that you can't, I mean, I'm very sorry that the show has been so on target because it's an awful target, but it hasn't been too hard to extrapolate about what's happening next.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of want to blame you for bringing things on, but then I can't really because you've just really been, you know, the whole idea of just every season, it's just been like amazing and just how it also just cuts to the bone of what's going on. But there was something that I think the idea also of watching it and being appreciative of what we have now.
I think that's the... I hope that that's the message you'd get out, is that you feel like June's life is so hard and so unfair that you can say, well, at least my life, at least it's not June. And look at June, she's finding some seams in a way she falls in love. I mean, good God, whoever would have thought that was possible?
Right, yeah.
I mean, I think Hulu said to me, well, you're not going to have any love triangles on this show. And I was like, no, I think we are. Anyway, it's so difficult. I think you do end up kind of appreciating what when she's funny, especially because it's inside. You know, she's not allowed to say it out loud. And so she's a lot, you know, she's a lot funnier than the people around her. You kind of secretly know that she's really a funny person. And it's the same with, it's, so the voiceover comes from point of view as well. It's all June's voiceover. She's the only character who ever has voiceover. And it's most of it's from the book or modeled on stuff from the book. And the songs that we have, the flashbacks are June's flashbacks most of the time. But the songs are generally what's what would pop into June's head unbidden. That's my idea behind how the songs come. So because that's how I do it when I watch the episode, I just go, that would really be funny if this was playing here. So it's a lot of like, you know, when you're, something's happening and you have a song in your head that seems incredibly inappropriate, but you're feeling very good about what you've done and it doesn't matter that, you know, the diapers are all over the room. You're feeling good, so you're singing some great song in your head. So, and Reed Morano really, we talked about that at the beginning. Reed did an amazing job. And she directed the first three episodes of this show. She had never directed a pilot before.
Wow.
She won an Emmy for it. She did a spectacular job. And we try to have as many women directors as we can. Mm. Some years we do better than others. And it ends up being a scheduling issue. We shoot two episodes at a time. So one, two, three, four, five, six. And so someone, in order to direct, has to come to us for 3 or 4 months. So it's a big chunk of their year. So they would rather do other things. But, you know, we're very lucky. We have almost for the whole time had female DPs, or for a lot of the time, which I think is that feminine eye is really important on the show. So.
Well, I mean, it is the female gaze through this. So, and, you know, you are seeing it more and more on television, but still not a lot. So, you know, but I want to get back to the music because... the music has been, when I was coming down here, I was singing, you know, you don't own me. And I'm like, why am I singing that? Oh, right, of course. But it's so, it says so much here. The sense of humor is in there, the sense of irony, and particularly when you were looking at Bradley Whitford's character and the mixtapes he had made for us. You get the sense of the people's past and where what they were before Gilead. Music is used in such a... creative way here, and not just as a soundtrack. It's as giving people's histories and who they were.
Well, thanks. In Gilead, it was so important because there was no music, so all the music she was hearing was in her head. There was, you know, little bits of music, but she wasn't choosing it. So that was really her own stereo system to kind of keep herself bucked up. The music is always a surprise. I mean, I generally choose the music. Mm. Lately, as Lizzie's been directing, she's been choosing some, and I have been, you know, even if I didn't know it, I've been trying to defer to her in that, because you don't want it to be all my taste. That right. doesn't help you guys have a good time. You want it to be a mix. And so, but the songs, I'm always trying to kind of add something to it. And also, I often feel like we're adding a little something to the song, because we often play women who aren't recognized as being particularly at the front of feminism or what you mm-hmm. call it. But in their way, Dolly Parton is a hero, and Taylor Swift is a hero, and Madonna, and all these people. And you play them at the right moment, you realize, oh my gosh, they're actually
Belinda Carlisle yeah. was amazing.
Oh my god, that's an amazing. I try not to waste anything. I feel like, you know, it's only a few episodes, it's only an hour, and all I have is pictures and sound. So if I'm going to choose a sound to put on there, it should add to your experience. So we have a lot of weird soundtrack stuff too.
Right.
Adam Taylor's our composer, who's amazing, and this is also his first series.
Wow.
He never did anything before this, and he does not read music. but he does our composing. But there's a nether world between the composing and the sound design, which is the footsteps and the kind of, there's a kind of a sounds that we do that are both in the world and on the soundtrack, and they work together, the composer and the sound design people. And I think when you were talking about the feminine gaze, it doesn't just come from the director. You have to have, the head of our production department is a woman, the head of our costume wardrobe department is a woman, the head of the line producer. So it's a line of women. I mean, I went to a production meeting yesterday and there were like 11, I was the only boy, and it happens a lot of the time. And so
did anybody make you go get their coffee?
They would if they could, believe me. They're very nice to me. They listen to me and everything. They, tolerate me very well.
Yeah.
No, it's great. I mean, but the, I can't do the production design from a woman's point of view. She can. So I just, you hire the right person, and she's, I mean, the production design on the show is astonishing.
Yeah.
But, and we do not have a zillion dollars. So I know. Looks like it's what you know.
It does look like it does. Somebody asked, how has the pandemic changed your story, or has it? That may be the one thing that has not been, or did I miss it?
They talked about a plague in the past, a plague that had helped. In the book, she talks about A strain, syphilis, or stuff. But there were plagues that went through before, and it was kind of, the pandemic, these kinds of things, what people thought was inevitable, that's what we had put in the past. The pandemic, story-wise, I think there's two things. One is just that I think I've changed, and the writers have changed, and all of us have changed as human beings, and we're writing the show. So in that way, it changes, just because I think, we're home. Everybody kind of either has lost their mind or found it, during the last few months.
Right.
So there's a lot of that pandemic change, but mostly it's changed the way we work. Season 4, which was the season, June got out of Toronto, got out to Toronto. Mm. Her friends got hit by the train. She, all of these things happened, and at the end she killed Fred, was all done before vaccines, before anything. So we did that with masks. And so what you're trying to do is create a little bubble for your actors where they can do their job normally, like there wasn't any.
Wow.
So your entire crew is set up so that one little bubble just feels like they don't feel like their day is any different, because it's hard for them to do. It's so hard for actors to do what they do. And it's a miracle how they do it. All out of order. And so that's what we were trying to do. But the writers had the same thing. We couldn't get together to write or get together to talk. And we did it via Zoom. And it took a long, long time to.
It took a lot longer to do it that way.
It took a long time for us to. It didn't take longer because we didn't have longer.
Oh, right. Yeah.
So
yeah.
We often just. Our whole life is like reverse Hanukkah. We have like a ton of oil to burn and like a day to burn it in. as opposed to the. So it's like, we're always just running at absolutely crazy. My wife is here somewhere, absolutely crazy full speed. So.
So if we can, did you have a question? Sure. Yeah, go ahead.
And we're, I can be loud. I work with a group called Rise Up for Abortion Rights. And we're recognizing that the Supreme Court is poised to overturn the right to abortion within 2 months, and that only the people can stop this by getting in the streets in mass, sustained, determined protest, because forced motherhood is female enslavement, as we see so painfully in the book and in your show. I specifically, and I've been thinking a lot about season two, and Lizzie in the Boston Globe, in the Boston Globe office, and you know, one of the problems we're up against right now is most people don't even know that they're about to lose the right to abortion, and they don't know it's a battering ram for a larger fascist program. The question. But season two, what strikes me as part of the point is. Not that we should be have seen this and relive it, and just kind of let's watch the pieces all fall into place before we live in a fascist America. But to stand up and do what they didn't do.
So to see the signs coming there is an element of kind of.
I want to talk to you afterwards.
There is kind of an element of prevention, which is that I think June says that the whole way through, which is if I just seen it coming. If I had just seen the signs, if I had just seen it coming. So, my feeling is that that's kind of what we all do is try to read the signs, in any situation. So once again, it kind of goes back to Margaret Atwood, which is, I think wherever you are, you feel like, Margaret's so bright, she feels like, well, why didn't I see this coming? Wherever you happen to be. And she's absolutely right. So I think it's interesting that the book really is the thing that put that model and makes that model work as a cautionary tale. And that's because it's speculative fiction. It's not science fiction. It's just a different now.
Mm. And I think also the idea, and season two particularly got at this too, was complacency. The complacency that people had and where they landed, not because of it, but partly because of it. I thought that was... And when Handmaids had debuted, wasn't it a couple months after Trump's inauguration? And all this stuff just felt like, and just seeing, it was good in a way that it's kind of a kick in the ass. Like, don't take the stuff for granted. Exactly what you were saying. Be grateful for what you have, but like, don't take it for granted.
And I think the crew, we were working right around then. Yeah. It was very good, especially for the people on the crew and the cast who were more political, to get back to work, because we actually felt like they were doing something, at least making a statement. But I'm not so sure this show wouldn't have been just as kind of prescient or just connected if it was the first 4 years of a first woman president. It would have been just as it would have been just dealing with the same issues. So.
Right. I can't see that clock up there. What's your question?
Hi there. First off, I want to thank you for staying with the book. As a person who works with the library, I'm grateful. Secondly, though, I wanted to ask, was there a reaction from fans or public that surprised you during these seasons, or something that maybe you didn't expect to hear back from how your episodes have gone, or something that was just a surprise for you?
As a regular writer, I was surprised anybody watched, at the beginning. So, but there have been tons of surprising things. I was at an event, and this young black man came up to me and was talking about how he watches it with his girlfriend and cries and all this kind of stuff. And he just was going on and on about how it particularly related to his wife and their experience. And it was lovely. I think the surprise is, and it shouldn't be a surprise, but the surprise is are the people who watch it are a lot more varied than I thought they would be. And a lot of that is because I wrote it for me. Because, it's like, I'm not the demographic for that book. So whatever appealed to me, I was hoping would appeal to somebody else. I think that it's the book, you know, had been very popular for a very long time, and so sticking with the book was the safe move.
We have time for one more question before Jess comes out and closes the
program. There's one here right in the front. I'm sorry, I can't see in the back, so...
Yeah, sure. Just as surprised as everybody else. I mean, I'm just, you know, doing my job, and most of my job this job is very workaday. I mean, to make a show like this, you're slugging away. So there's a lot of attention to that, and you look up, and the world has changed. Absolutely. Yeah. No. So I'm only more shocked because I pay less attention, but I don't think it's. I don't think Margaret's shocked.
Mm. And season 5 is going to land, is it in July? Or did I just make that up?
No, I think it lands in July. I was hoping on the 4th of July, but I don't know if we get that this year.
Mm.
We haven't done that yet. Yes, it lands.
Celebrate America with season 5 of...
Our cast, who is the most lovely, respectful group of people, also... move their entire schedules around to come back every year. A lot of these people, like, you know, Bradley Whitford doesn't need to come back to our show, and Madeline Brewer and, you know, Alexis and all of these people don't need to come back, but they move their schedules around to come back. And so I appreciate everyone's patience, because the reason it takes longer is we don't want to make it without Bradley, and we don't want to do it without, and sometimes we have to, sometimes we lose people, especially this year, we, you know, people couldn't travel back. You know, we'd written whole stories for people, they just couldn't get into America. But I appreciate everybody's patience, because I think I'd rather wait and make, because it's going to last forever, you know, after we're all gone. And so you want it to be a kind of a nice little DVD you can put between Handmaids and Testaments on your shelf.
I'm thinking with that, thank you so much. This has been fantastic, and thank you for being here.
Thank you both. This is great. And thank you all for being here. And on the 26th, we have Jennifer Egan and Danzy Senna with her new book, well, Jennifer's new book, Candy House. So please come back. We're happy to be live again and happy to have you guys here this evening.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for the wonderful discussion.
That was great.
Aloud is made possible by the Hearst Foundation, the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, the Los Angeles County Department of Arts and Culture, Errant Fox, City National Bank, the Los Angeles Public Library, and additional generous supporters of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. To support programs like this, become a member at lfla.org.